I'm going to start today at 1 Peter 3:15. If you'd turn there with me, 1 Peter 3:15. It's a scripture I think we've all heard many times. 1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be always ready to give a defense to everyone who asks for a reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear. The old King James says to be ready to give an answer. And so we are to be able to defend our faith. It's very important, especially in this day and age, to those that ask. I think the last few words here, with meekness and fear. So we have to do it humbly, but we need to be able to give an answer when we're questioned. And this has to be an answer of concerning the hope that is within us, and this hope has to have a solid foundation, and it must be backed by knowledge. If we don't have knowledge, we won't have a solid foundation. Ephesians 4, verse 13. Ephesians 4, verse 13. Till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. So knowledge is what we need to have so we're not tossed to and fro. And there are a lot of winds blowing these days to try and toss us to and fro. I still remember a course that I took my first term in college, and the professor said, I'm going to take everything you believe, and I'm going to tear it apart, which sounds kind of wild. But he was saying that he was going to take things that we think that we know, and he's going to make us examine them to make sure that what we know is it really has something behind it. Or do we have a basis for our beliefs? This is called critical thinking, and there are courses in college on critical thinking. And these are critical times that we're in. As never before, we need to worry about and think about the depth of our knowledge and knowing what really backs up our faith. So we need to know that take about our faith seriously, take it seriously, being able to defend it, to our children, to families, to anyone really that asks, and also probably most importantly to ourselves. If we can't defend our faith to ourselves, we can't defend it to anyone. So my title today is Defending Our Faith. I brought part of my library today. This is a bit of a show and tell. There are some things I'd like to share with you today. I want to start with a book that my wife Karen introduced me to and had me read. It's called Already Gone, Why Your Kids Will Quit the Church and What You Can Do to Stop It. And it's written by Ken Ham and Britt Beamer. The book describes a survey that they took of young adults in their 20s, all church-going people, so church-going young adults in their 20s. And the book is chock full of statistics, and some are kind of shocking. It mentions that during elementary and middle school, 95% regularly attended church. So again, they're all from church-going families. But by the end of high school, this was down to 11%. 11%. So they were already gone by the end of high school. You know, we tend to think that students are, you know, lose their religion, you lose their faith in college, but here it had already happened in high school. In high school classes, there are scientific demonstrations, conservation of energy, force and acceleration, chemical reactions, electricity, magnetism. You know, students are wowed by science. I was back in high school. All these absolutes that I'm learning. And then comes biology class. I still remember quite vividly in biology class, we had a teacher. He had his white jacket on and was up in front of the class, and he was dissecting a frog. And I guess I remember it because the feeling in my stomach, I'm really not into that sort of thing. I would never be a doctor. So here he was having what seemed to be a good time. He was taking all these little parts out of the frog. Here's the heart, here's the liver, here are the lungs, here's this and that, and laying them out on the table. And you're saying, here are the same components that are in our bodies. Well, then comes evolution. And so the students tend to think, well, science are so good about what they're doing and so exacting, this must be true also. The book Already Gone advocates a website, Answers in Genesis. And there is some good material there, but they believe in the young earth, what we call the young earth theory, that the earth was created actually 6,000 years ago. And we don't teach that. In Genesis 1, at the very beginning, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Well, it could be translated, the earth became. That's what we've used in some of our literature in the church. Looking at different translations, it indicates that the earth did exist before the 6 days of creation, what we call the 6 days of creation. But it was in a tremendously devastated state. Now, Genesis 1 begins a new era, something new that God is doing. He's working with human beings now, and he has this plan that he has started and is carrying out. And so it's a completely new era. And what happened before that, I think perhaps God really feels, you know, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't, as far as what he's doing, it's really none of our business, perhaps. Or doesn't, we do, not something we need to know. One argument for the young earth theory is ocean salinity. Measuring the time of creation by how the oceans gain salinity as material was dissolved and flushed into the oceans. At a conference on historical dating methods, Ryan McGillivray from the University of South Dakota presented a paper titled Ocean Salinity as a Failed Scientific Clock. And he had this to say, for a process to be considered a good natural clock, it must contain the following: a known initial condition, an irreversible process, a uniform rate, and final conclusion or final condition. Well, he's just shot down all the methods that man has for judging the age of the earth, because we can't really guarantee any of these factors. And once your evidence is discredited, your credibility is gone. So we have to be careful as far as that goes. And I'm back to Already Gone again. There's something kind of interesting they have to say here. And those children or the young adults in their 20s now who dropped out of church, the dropout rate was higher among those who had gone to Bible study. Well, my parents sent me to Bible study for a short time, and I remember was I didn't like it, and I complained about it, and so it didn't last very long, but which is probably good. So if what is taught in Sunday school is stories like Jonah and the whale and Noah and the flood, you know, Satan can make young people think, well, it's just a bunch of fairy tales. So again, we need to think about the depth of our knowledge and our faith. I'd like to turn to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, starting in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit down in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your head, and they shall be a frontlet between your eyes. So concerning these young people, you know, we're commanded to teach our young people, to teach our family. But if Bible study is left up to Sunday school, I think we have a problem. Karen and I attended some meetings quite a few years ago in the United Church, the UCG Youth Education Task Force. The emphasis there was on getting parents involved in teaching their children at home, teaching about the Bible. And I know I've been bothered, and I think Karen has over the years, of thinking, you know, that some of the Sabbath schools we have were just to keep the children occupied and really somehow make them interested in going to church, which really is not the right goal. So we can't really teach and convert and convince others unless we can teach and convince our own selves and our family. There are four important things that God has done that we do believe in. He has designed our physical bodies with a complexity beyond our wildest imagination. He has created a very special and unique environment for us, this earth that we live in and live upon. He has created a plan that he is working out, and we're about to go over part of that plan at the feast, or the holy days, showing that plan. He has given us a comprehensive textbook containing Earth's history and instructions. So how do we come to strengthen our belief in all of these things? There are some very good sources out there. Absolute proofs are hard to come by, but there can be overwhelming evidence, sometimes completely overwhelming, that really is a proof. For the Western world today, evolution is it's a myth of creation. So every society has what we call their creation myths. A myth is a story which could be true or false. So in this modern world, evolution is the common creation myth. In other words, man has devised his own story about the existence and purpose or lack thereof of human beings. And it's very deeply embedded in our educational system. People call our creation myth intelligent design by an infinitely wise God. So that's our, what we call creation myth, and it's true. One time when I was teaching, before I retired, there was a position open in the biology department. And one of the men that came to interview, during the interview, he admitted that he believed in intelligent design. Well, that he became the laughingstock of the faculty forum, the internet forum. I remember one comment: intelligent design is to evolution as astrology is to astronomy. And that's kind of a common, I think, belief amongst college faculty. So, of course, he didn't get the job. You can't believe in creation by evolution and creation by God. The two are really mutually exclusive. There will be rebuttals against any case that we make for our belief. There will always be detractors. The key, can we make a strong enough case for ourselves, for our families, for our children, and for others who ask? Again, absolute truth is hard to come by, but if we can make a strong enough case, it can absolutely justify our faith. Two books that I brought, I think they're quite important, are by Michael Behe. One is The Edge of Evolution and Darwin's Black Box. Now, Michael Behe is a biochemist, and biochemistry has made some tremendous advances and discoveries in the last few decades. They've been able to analyze what's actually going on in the body chemically, the various enzymes and proteins and how they all interact, and they've been able to map these things out in the processes. They actually map out how systems are functioning in the body. And his books really shoot down the theory of evolution, if anything ever did. The Edge of Evolution, I'll start with that, discusses what are the limits to the theory of evolution when it comes to a random mutations. Or how far can mutations go? What is the limit mathematically? There are three distinct parts to the theory of evolution, a common ancestor, natural selection, or survival of the fittest, and random mutations. The first is false. The second, survival of the fittest, can be true in some instances, to some extent. The third, random mutations, these do occur. And so we need to study into that. From generation to generation, DNA is copied. And the copying is quite accurate, but errors do occur. It's estimated that one time in 100 million is one part of a gene copied incorrectly to the next gene of the next generation. So the vast majority of these errors are detrimental. In a case, there might be something beneficial, but generally they are detrimental and cause some form of disease. Today, men can analyze and compare DNA, and from these samples, they can identify when mutations have occurred. And there's been much research in the area of malaria because it's been such a curse on mankind. In Behe's book, The Edge of Evolution, he has a very long discussion of the malaria organism. Much research in mutations has been done in the area of drug resistance. And because of the size of the malaria problem and the size of the data available, it's a very good case to study as far as mutations go. The malaria argument goes like this. Consider 1 billion people infected with malaria at a particular time, and each person carrying about 1 trillion malaria parasites. That's 1 billion trillion parasites. So if you thought our national debt was bad, this is a very, very large sample size to be dealing with. And going on, the chance that a mutation in a particular gene from generation to generation, if that's 1 in 100 million, and the number of genes in the malaria organism, there's a chance, there's 1 million million organisms, and a chance of a mutation occurring 1 in 100 million, and so the chances are almost certain that something will happen very quickly there. And so it happens in a very short time that a parasite can become resistant to some new drug. If it takes two different and independent mutations to block a drug, in this case, quinine, the chances are 1 trillion times 1 trillion. And if you look at what happened in malaria, the resistance did occur about a decade later. It took time because the chances were so much lower. But it did happen. Now, science considers the chimpanzee to be our closest ancestor because of the similarities in our DNA. So what are the chances of random mutations transferring a chimp to man? Well, to do a comparison, consider the population, 100 million chimps versus a million trillion parasites, a gestation period of years instead of a few days, and the number of mutations to accomplish this change from chimp to man. Now, the time required is a number too great to even contemplate. It's just out of the universe. Another case under study was the E. coli bacteria. Now, this resides in our intestinal tract. And a study at Michigan State University maintained a culture of E. coli bacteria for 10 years to study the mutations. The E. coli gestation period is about 20 minutes, so 20 minutes from generation to generation. So in 10 years, there were 260,000 generations, passing on any possible mutations, and the results, not much happened. There were just a small number of incoherent changes, but it was still E. coli. Darwin's other book, Darwin's Black Box, discusses intelligent design and what he terms irreducible complexity. I'd like to read just a couple of passages from this book. One about irreducible complexity. So this is from Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe on page 39. And he starts off with a quote by Darwin. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And then Behe comments here, what type of biological system could not be formed by numerous successful slight modifications? Well, for starters, a system that is irreducibly complex. By irreducibly complex, I mean a system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one part causes the system to effectively cease functioning. That would be considered irreducible complexity. An irreducibly complex system cannot be produced directly by slight successive modifications of a precursor system, because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. This is a powerful challenge to Darwin's evolution. So natural selection can only choose from systems that are already working. As I mentioned, biochemistry has made tremendous advances in the last few decades, analyzing the design of different functions of the body. And Behe mentions quite a number of them in the book. I think one of the most amazing to me—was the function of the eye. And I'd like to just see what he has to say about that. So beginning on page 18, again, Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe, starting on page 18. And I want to read just a couple of paragraphs. You have to be a biochemist ready to understand what he's saying here. And he gives a little symbol here that this is sort of an aside just to indicate the complexity. It really is mind-boggling. So starting on page 18, when light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis-retinal, which rearranges within picoseconds to transretinal. The change in the shape of the retinal molecule forces the change in the shape of the protein rhodopsin, to which the retinal is strung is tightly bound, and it alters its the protein metamorphosis and alters its behavior. Now it's called meta-rhodopsin, and it sticks to another protein called transducin. Before bumping into meta-rhodopsin, transducin had tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when transducin interacts with meta-rhodopsin, the GDP falls off, and a molecule called GTP binds instead. Now, GDP, meta-rhodopsin, now binds to a protein called phosphodiesterase, located in the inner membrane of the cell. When attached to meta-rhodopsin and its entourage, the protodiesterase acquires a chemical ability to cut a molecule called cGMP. Initially, there are a lot of cGMP molecules in the cell, but after the phosphodiesterase lowers its concentration, another membrane called that binds to the cGMP is called an ion channel. It acts as a gateway that regulates the number of sodium ions in the cell. Normally, the ion channel allows sodium ions to flow into the cell. A separate protein actually pumps them out. The dual action of the ion channel and the pump keeps the level of sodium ions in the cell within a narrow range. When the amount of cGMP is reduced because of the cleavage of the phosphodiesterase, the ion channel closes, causing a cellular concentration of positively charged ions to be reduced. This causes an imbalance of charge across the cell that finally causes the current to be translated down the optic nerve to the brain, and the result is vision. Wow. So, again, this was a little optional piece he put in there just to show the complexity, and they're actually able to map out these processes that go on within the body. But this is only half the story. Here, all these changes have occurred to produce this little bit of current that goes down the optic nerve. But now it has to reset back to the original condition for the next photon that comes along. And that's just as complex, if not more so. So we have this huge complex operation. And this whole process has to be repeated 10 or 20 times a second so we can see motion. And I think, well, couldn't God have found a simpler way to do this? You know, we can convert light to electricity with a little silicon or crystal. But I think God has sort of overdone it. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but he's made things really complex to show the power of his mind and what he's able to do and what he's designed. I'd like to turn to Romans 1, verse 20. This is a scripture we've heard often. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So we see the power of God's mind really in just one instance of this design of the human body. But if we look around us, it's in everything. The world we live in is absolutely designed for our habitation. Well, this, what I read above, just describes how the eye converts into an electric current. But there's so much more. The iris controls the amount of light that's entering the eye. The diameter of the opening is controlled by a set of muscles. It is really part of what we could call a closed loop feedback system. Light is sensed by the retina. This information goes to the brain. The brain sends a signal to the muscles that if there's too much light, it constrains the iris, and the amount of light hitting the retina is reduced. What if it overcorrects and cuts off too much? And then the brain calls for more light, and if this overcorrection can just cycle, we'd see just a fluttering. So the body is full of these feedback control systems. And a feedback control system, if you've designed one as an engineer, it has to be quite exacting in its parameters, or it's not going to be stable. Another design of the eye is the center of vision, called the fovea. And that's about a 2-degree little slice of our whole field of vision. And it has the resolution, really, that allows 20/20 vision. About half of the nerves that go into the eye over the optic nerve bundle, about half of those come from this little tiny area, which gives that phenomenal resolution. If, like a camera, we had equal resolution over the whole field of vision, how could you read? You overload. You couldn't concentrate on any little tiny spot. And we'd have difficulty doing about anything in life. So here's another design feature that's quite incredible that you don't see in cameras. Here's an experiment. Just close one eye and force yourself to look at one letter in some text. And while you just maintain your center of focus on that letter, try and tell what the letters are just a few places away. And you can't do it because you don't have the resolution. So it's interesting. From a little Googling on the internet, I found a number for the number of gigapixels in the human eye, and what I found was 576 gigapixels. So if you think of 576 gigapixels from each eye going into the brain, and the brain has to instantly convert that into a three-dimensional image, another very phenomenal thing. One more thing. The brain can cover blind spots in the eye. There's always a blind spot, and then they're off to the side. I know about where mine are because I've done this experiment. But it's where the optic nerves comes into the eye, and you can have damage to your eye that causes other blind spots. And I've had this happen. But one time, our kids toilet papered our bedroom, and taking it down, they tore off a little piece of tape on the ceiling and left a spot where the paint is missing. And I can land bad, and I can look up and move my eye till I center that blind spot over that spot, and the ceiling then is perfectly white. You know, the bad spot is gone. So that's another experiment you can try. Just find something that's quite small. Could even be something on a page, you know, and move your eye and about like this, and you can make things disappear. So not only is the eye an example of irreducibly complex, it's really irreducibly complex in such an extreme example. Behe has other examples in his book, such as blood clotting and the immune system. They're both tremendously complex. Blood clotting has to happen only where there is bleeding and has to be precisely controlled. It doesn't get out of hand and block arteries. The COVID injections have been known to cause blood clots, which can be quite dangerous. So really, every medication that man devises has some side effects. There's hopefully more good than bad, that's what we depend upon, but there's always some side effect. So intelligent design presents what we call an elephant in the room. Behe mentions that. He says, the scientist's refusal to acknowledge the elephant in the room is that one side of the elephant says intelligent design, and the other side says God. And to scientists, we can't talk about God. I'd like to go to Psalm 139. Psalm 139, starting in verse 13. For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. So David knew that God designed our body, and we're finding that out. And we're finding that out very, very clearly through biochemistry right now. Another book I brought is In the Beginning, Compelling Evidence for Creation and the Flood by Walt Brown. This is an unusual book in that there are no restrictions on it. It's all on the internet. You can in the website is www.creationscience.com. www.creationscience.com. And you can read the whole book on the internet. You can copy off anything you want to use in a class or any way you want to use it, or just use different topics for your own study. Now, he was an evolutionist until his studies showed the impossibility of the theory. Walt Brown has a PhD in engineering from MIT. He's a retired Air Force colonel. He taught at the Air Force Academy, so he has quite good credentials. But that doesn't mean we can believe everything that he wrote, because a lot of really pretty much what he wrote is there's quite a bit of speculation. So most of what he wrote is speculation, but he does provide some very good examples and some arguments in favor of creation, and some things to research further. In the book, he lists 131 categories of evidence for creation, from biology, astronomy, and the physical and earth sciences, and he gives a paragraph or more about each one. He does spend a lot of time on the flood. Of course, the Bible tells us about the flood, and practically every ancient culture has legends about the flood, about a traumatic flood that in which only a few people survived by boat. So it is pretty much a universal story, but it is discredited by scientists, which then discredits the Bible. If you believe in Jesus Christ, you have to believe in the flood, because he mentions the flood, Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 38. For in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. So Jesus Christ believed in the flood, and so do we. Now, the scientific world assumes a uniform Earth model that gradually changed over millions or billions of years. Land masses creep, plate tectonics, glaciers ebbing and flowing, carving features leading to the Earth as it appears today. But the flood completely upsets all of these conclusions. The flood is a mammoth cataclysm resulting in the Earth, really happening on Earth in a very short time. In the book, in the beginning, Walt Brown formulated a theory of how the flood occurred, and it's basically compatible with the Bible. According to Brown's theory, a crack opened and propagated clear around the Earth. And where did all the water come from? Well, Genesis 7. Genesis 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. So there was a great deal of water underground. And according to Brown's theory, an awesome amount of water under great pressure. And once a crack opened, it was like busting a balloon. And this crack then propagated around the globe, and this vast amounts of water shot up and into the atmosphere and then came down. And this was the fountains of the great deep. Well, in this tremendous event, some land collapsed where these cracks were, and the ocean trenches were formed. Mountains were pushed up. Some earth was moved sideways, just a tremendous upheaval worldwide. And I was kind of thinking, on Noah's Ark, it must have been kind of a bumpy ride. I think God really must have intervened there and kept them in some fairly calm waters. There are a couple of pictures here that I think are rather profound. One shows all the sediment layers. Perhaps you can't do it too well on the camera, but here's a tree trunk going through all these layers of sediment. And this has been witnessed several places. After Mount St. Helens erupted, sediment layers were formed in the bottom of Spirit Lake, and there were tree trunks stuck in that, similar to this picture, but much smaller, not as many layers, but still the same effect. Another picture here shows there are mountains that are just jammed together like an accordion, and so how things were pushed sideways. And this has occurred in some places. Now, if the earth was perfectly smooth right now, the water would be 9,000 feet deep, so there had to be a tremendous change in the whole layout of the earth. The oceans had to be, well, and all this water came out, the oceans then had a place to sink. The mountains were pushed up, and the dry land appeared. Well, there are some points to consider in explaining our faith. One is that we need to study. I'd like to turn to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 2:15, be diligent and present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So we need to keep studying God's word, but studying this world around us and maintaining our faith. It takes continual study, really, to maintain something that's strong in our minds, because things tend to fade in the mind. So you have to keep up on scientific research and see what's going on, I think especially in biochemistry. And then in some of the astronomy, we have the new telescope out there that's providing some awesome pictures. Number two, watch out for tricky and insincere questions. Matthew 22. Starting in verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay tax to Caesar or not? And Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius, and he said to them, Whose image and description is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's. So they tried to trick Christ with questions, but he had a rebuttal for them. Today in politics, especially, people were asked questions to try and make them look bad, to trick them up. Look at Proverbs 26. Proverbs 26, just a short couple of sentences. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like unto him. So there will be people that try and trick us. We might be asked a question designed to make us look stupid. You know, you don't believe in evolution. How dumb and out of step can you be with the rest of the scientific world? Well, scientists have done a tremendous deep research now. And if they're honest about it, many now no longer believe in the evolution. So I say we're on the right side. Christ answered a fool according to his folly. And we need to think about a response if we're asked something that's not sincere. Number three, ask or answer when you're asked seriously. And Matthew 7, verse 6, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they come and trample them under their feet, and turn and tear you in pieces. So we can't just spew out what we believe and be a show-off. We need to be able to give an answer when it's sincerely asked in a right way, and do it humbly. Maybe one more verse along that line, Proverbs 9. Proverbs 9, verse 7, he who corrects a scoffer gets shame for himself, and he who rebukes a wicked man only harms himself. So we need to give advice or answer questions when they're asked honestly. Number four, we need to teach our children. That's a responsibility, our children and actually our families. Deuteronomy 11. Deuteronomy 11, verse 18. Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets before your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit down in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down and when you rise up. So God's word and the true things that we believe in and truly believe in need to be taught to our children and our families. Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6. Verse 4. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. So, again, we need to teach our children what is true and about God and creation and all that he's done. Finally, number five, be an example of a person of understanding. Philippians 2, verse 14. Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain. So, we are to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, as Christ said, and that's in Matthew 10:16. And Matthew 5, verse 7. I'm sorry, Matthew 5, verse 16. Matthew 5, verse 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So we are to be lights to the world. If this causes us to be questioned in a sincere way, we need to be ready to give an answer humbly and have a response for what we truly believe in our hearts. So in a summary, what am I saying? We need to be doing some studying. We need to make sure that our faith has a solid foundation. Romans 1:22. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them over to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. So this is the world that we live in. This is a story of a modern society. And God says, you know, if you think you're wise, as people do today, I'll show you who's wise. So he shows us some remarkable things that he has created that truly are astonishing. I go back to where I started. 1 Peter 3:15. Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. So be ready to give an answer to our children, to our families, to others who ask honestly. First of all, to ourselves, because if the answer is not in our own minds and ourselves, we can't share it with anyone else.